10 minutes?
Mr. Chief Justice, I want to address first why this law is reasonable and should be sustained and why the judgment below has to be reversed. However, whatever position you take on the theories of the amendment, and in defending the eminent reasonableness and careful balance of this law, I need to start with the trigger lock about which Justice Alito asked.
Well, before you start with it, how many minutes does it take to remove a trigger lock and load a gun? Because both of the gun has to be unloaded. It has to have a trigger lock under the district law.
Those are alternatives, Mr. Chief Justice.
Well, disassembly and trigger lock.
And unlock.
In either case, it has to be unloaded, correct?
There are some versions of the trigger lock that allow you to put the trigger lock on and then load the gun. The piece that goes in the trigger mechanism, even someone as clumsy as I can remove it in a second.
Well, but the law, as I understand it, says that the gun has to be unloaded. So under your hypothetical, I assume that would violate the district's law if the gun is still loaded.
It's a question where you put the parentheses. I read that as disassembled and unloaded or under a trigger lock. And that's the way that...
So how long does it take, if your interpretation is correct, how long does it take to remove the trigger lock and make the gun operable?
You place a trigger lock on, and it has the version I have, a few that you can buy them at the 17th Street Hardware, has a code, like a three-digit code. You turn to the code, and you pull it apart. That's all it takes. Even someone, it took me 3 seconds.
Lamp next to your bed. So you can turn the knob in 3, 22, 95.
Now,
somebody.
Well,
is it like that? Is it a numerical code?
Yeah, you can have one with.
So then you turn on the lamp, you pick up your reading glasses.
Let me tell you. That's right. Let me tell you why. At the end of the day, this doesn't matter. For two reasons.
Not matter, but I'd like some idea about how long it takes.
It took me 3 seconds. I'm not kidding. It's not that difficult to do it. That was in daylight. The other version is just a loop that goes through the chamber with a simple key. You have to have the key and put it together. Now, of course, if you want to have your weapon loaded and assembled, that's a different matter. But here's where I want to address the trigger lock. Here's why it doesn't matter for the handgun law. The district believes that what is important here is the ban on handguns. And it also believes that you're entitled to have a functional, usable weapon for self-defense in the home, and that's why this is a very proportionate law.
Well, if proportionate, in other words, you're saying your interest is allowing self-defense in the home. Does it really make sense to say the best self-defense arm is a rifle as opposed to a pistol?
It is. There has been no showing here that a rifle or a shotgun is inadequate for the purposes of self-defense in this facial challenge.
Is there anything to show that the district council ever considered the issue of self-defense? That because they banned handguns and they had this provision on the trigger lock, my question with the trigger lock doesn't have to do with whether trigger locks are generally a good idea. It's whether you're ever allowed to take it off for purposes of defense. There's no. Is there anything to show that the council actually considered what sort of weapon is appropriate for self-defense?
There are decisions in the District of Columbia about the right of self-defense that apply to this. But here's the most important point. It cannot affect the validity of the handgun law. If you disagree with us that my statements are not sufficient to say that we believe that the law should be read, given the self-defense compulsion, to allow whatever use makes it functional. If you don't agree with that, and if you think there's a controversy on this point, because we believe you should have a functional firearm available in the home of law-abiding citizens who wish one. If we're wrong about that and the trigger lock is invalid, that has no effect on the handgun ban. That is to say, the trigger lock applies to all weapons. If it's valid and it means what they say it does, none of the weapons would work. You don't need a handgun. It's unusable. If it's invalid, or if it has the construction we believe, it cannot possibly affect the handgun law. If you strike down the trigger lock law, you're throwing us in the briar patch where we think we're happy to be. If all we have to do is to make clear in the trigger lock law what we have said here today, that it's available for self-defense.
It's a related point. Do you understand the carry ban to apply if you carry the firearm from one room in the house to another?
That only applies if it's unregistered. Now, you can't register a handgun, you can't carry a handgun, but that's because its possession is prohibited. That is to say, you can't carry marijuana or heroin from one room to the other either, because you can't use it at all. I think
why is the D.C. law phrased in those terms? In other words, if you can't have a handgun at all, why do you have a separate provision saying you can't carry it anywhere?
Well, it's the carry provision. You cannot carry unregistered firearms. That's just a general requirement that firearms be registered. You're not allowed to register handguns is the mechanism by which they are prohibited. Now, here is... To address your question about why a ban is unreasonable, the one thing we know the Second Amendment is not about is it's not about the interests of collectors. Some people collect guns the way they do stamps. And if that were what the amendment were about, then prohibiting someone from having a particular type of gun would prevent them from completing the set. But the notion that...
Well, isn't that covered by the provision that you have the right to keep arms?
Well, the word keep would encompass, keep can encompass every use of an arm, and that's why it provides no limit at all unless you read it in combination with keep and bear, and that in combination with well-regulated militia.
You mean you can't have any more arms than you would need to take with you to the militia? You can't have, a turkey gun and a duck gun and a 30-06 and a 270 and, you know, different hunting guns for different... you can't do that. I mean, a state could say...
Of course you can do that.
You can have a 12-gauge
in a district, and like the district that allows that, as every state does. There are...
At least for me, the question is, what would be the constitutional basis insisting on Justice Scalia's suggestion that you need a number of guns. You have argued, it seems to me, that the district or a government could prohibit just what he said, unless you needed one to take to the militia.
I do not know why that would pass the reasonableness scrutiny that this law would, because a powerful, overwhelming case could be made that you're eliminating the one type of weapon. This law is designed only for the weapon that is concealable and movable, that can be taken into schools and onto the metro, can be easily stolen and transmitted among children.
I'm asking about the constitutional standard you apply to a hypothetical statute which would prohibit the guns Justice Scalia described. What is your position as to the validity of such a hypothetical law?
You would apply this standard. You would ask whether the ban is one that's carefully balanced the considerations of gun ownership and public safety. I don't see how, once we're in the land where there is a right, there's a far weaker case that there's any need for public safety to limit the number of guns one has. Here, there is an overwhelming case, and we are talking about local legislation. I know, Justice Kennedy, that you would be concerned about a national government which sets a single standard for rural and urban areas, for east and west, north and south. Here you have legislation that is adopted by a group of citizens in the district operating under the authority of Congress, but it is local legislation. And if it's still good law that states and local governments across the country can strike these balances, as they have, it would be deeply ironic to preclude the District of Columbia as being the only place that could enact legislation free of the strictures of the Second Amendment. And when you ask about the statistics, what is critical here is not to apply the kind of categorical standard the court below did or a kind of strict scrutiny that would strike this law down. This is an area, unlike areas where government regulation is presumptively illegitimate, this text contemplates regulation of inherently dangerous weapons, and where the great battle over methodology to which Justice Breyer replied in these briefs, indicates that this is the kind of right where you have disputes among experts. It's a kind of right where even if you recognize it, deference needs to be given to the legislative resolution rather than have courts try to decide how best to resolve the statistical and methodological debates. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Dellinger. The case is submitted.